Welcome to Staying Sane in Trying Times number 9. Today I'm going to do 15 minutes of meditation, followed by a 30-minute talk, including at least one fun and easy-to-use technique to bring greater equanimity and poise to your life. So these techniques work shockingly well when you use them, so we're going to use them together. And my goal is to not just provide you with a little personal training session for your brain, but rather to introduce you to techniques that will hold you in good stead for the rest of your lives. The idea is to incorporate these techniques into your life so they become habits. Good to see you, my friend on Facebook, Neil. Welcome. And Sanjay, welcome. Sharon, welcome. Dana, welcome. And if you could be so kind as to put in the chat where you are logging in from. So I'm here in Santa Monica, California, where it is an unseasonably warm day. Apparently, we're hitting record highs in downtown LA today, and it's pretty darn warm up here. I've shut the window, so if I melt into a puddle, you'll know why. But with the meditation, we might be able to cool down a little bit. All right. New Jersey by way of Philly. Dana, welcome. Sharon in DC, welcome. Sanjay from Boston, welcome. All right, fantastic. So today what I have for you, Kimberly in Pasadena, welcome. Marit in Salt Lake City, fantastic. So what we've got for you today here is a very empowering meditation. This is metta meditation, loving kindness meditation from various Buddhist traditions. And the idea is that when you do this metta meditation, what you're doing is you're strengthening that compassion muscle that you've always had. And you may have thought that that was a muscle that you couldn't train. And you went to the gym and you look at the kettlebells, you look at the rubber bands, you look at the pull-up bar, and you're like, where's the machine for strengthening my compassion? Well, guess what? We've got that machine for you right here today. So in a couple of minutes, I'm going to begin that as people roll into the session. And welcome. Welcome all my friends on Facebook Live. And in about a minute, let's start that metta meditation. How many of you have a regular meditation practice? Go ahead and put that in the chat box here. If you do not, I encourage you to take this opportunity that we have here with potentially more time on your hands. If you were commuting before and your commute was 20 to 30 minutes each way, that means you have about an hour of time on your hands now that you did not before, unless you have kids crawling all over you, which is a different issue, I understand that, but maybe after they fall asleep. So the point is that this is an extraordinary opportunity as well as a crisis. Some wise person said, never let a good crisis go to waste. So we're going to do this meditation technique together and see how you like it. And this particular version doesn't take that long. In fact, I think it'll come in under 15 minutes a day. And notice how that makes you feel. So as I do with all the other sessions, I invite you to right now assess yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 on both the happiness scale and the misery scale, because these are two different circuits in your brain. So the numbers could actually not make a lot of sense. You could be very high on the happiness scale, but also high on the misery scale. So go ahead and assess that right now. So 10 on the happiness scale is woohoo! Oh my God, it's New Year's Eve. Life is amazing every day. And 10 on the misery scale is down in the dumps. You know, cat died, wife left, car crash, the usual. So, so make that assessment. And then what we're going to do is we're going to do a post assessment at the very end as well. And once you've done that, we are going to begin. So welcome, welcome all my friends on Facebook Live. So take a deep breath and close your eyes. As you do that, I invite you to think of a person in your life for whom you have total unconditional love. Now, this could be a child. This could be a relative. This could be somebody living or deceased. This could be somebody else entirely. It could be a pet. But the key here is to find that one person for whom you have this feeling of deep, unquestioning affection. Okay. You found that person? Great. I invite you to summon that feeling of deep warmth and affection, unconditional love, right? And send it to that person. Imagine you have a hologram of that person in front of you, and you are sending it to that person. And you say, either silently or aloud, you say, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be joyous. May you be safe. May you be healthy. And really feel it, like really go for it here. Imagine that person's really in the room, and for this one person for whom you have unconditional love, that should be pretty straightforward. It should be pretty easy. There's a few people I can think of who are that way. So you just go, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be joyous. And then imagine that person also sending a beam of positive energy and light to you and saying, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be healthy. May you be joyous. May you be safe. And notice how that feels and really take it in. Because what we're going to do is we're going to continue with this exercise with people who are maybe not natural subjects for our feeling of compassion. The next person is going to be somebody who is a little more difficult to love unconditionally. So maybe it's a conditional love. Maybe it's a family member or a spouse or a coworker, somebody for whom you have affection, but maybe it's a little more difficult for you to have that unconditionally. So go ahead. And that same feeling you had from that last person for whom you had unconditional love, boom, beam it to this new person here and say, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be joyous. And you can use whatever mix that you find works for you. I particularly like health, joy, happiness, safety. And the idea is you're wishing all these things upon them. Active compassion. And now go ahead and feel that coming right back to you from that person. As that person says to you, may you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be joyous. May you be at peace. May you be safe. Great. Now we're going to move on down to the next person. Next person is someone for whom you have neutral feelings. This could be the last person who handed you your groceries in a store. This could be a random passerby on the street that you drove past. This could be anybody whom you don't know very well at all, whom you can still imagine vividly. And go ahead and bring out that feeling of deep compassion and warmth, that unconditional love you had for that very first person. Now beam it towards this person here. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be joyous. May you be safe. And what makes this practice effective is to imagine very specific people, not a general person, but someone you actually see, someone you actually perhaps know a little bit. That's what makes it real. And then imagine that same person now saying it right back to you. Imagine that hologram of that person connecting to you at your heart level. And that person is saying, may you be happy. May you be joyous. May you be at peace. May you be safe. The fourth person, this is the challenge round of the compassion meditation. Now you're going to find someone for whom you have mostly negative feeling towards, maybe even overwhelmingly negative feelings towards. It's important to do this because that particular person needs your compassion the most, because if they did feel safe, joyous, and at ease, and safe, and healthy, maybe they wouldn't be acting out the way they are. So go ahead and find that person. Maybe you have to grit your teeth a little bit, but go ahead. Let's do it together. Find that person and go, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be healthy. May you have joy. May you feel safe. The next person you're going to do this is someone who is perhaps even more challenging for some of us. For some of us, the most challenging. For other people, maybe pretty easy. It's going to be you. It's going to be yourself. So go ahead and imagine a hologram of you standing over there. And to that person, who happens to have a remarkable resemblance to you, you say, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be safe. May you be joyous. May you be healthy. And notice how that hologram can say the same to you and connect to you. May you be happy. May you be joyous. May you be at peace. May you be healthy. May you be safe. And for a little extra oomph, imagine that hologram turning around and merging with you. So, that entity that you gave compassion to is you. So feel that deep compassion for yourself. And right now, as you're doing this compassion meditation, imagine that the whole point of this compassion meditation is to radiate it outwards. You had it easily for the person for whom you had unconditional love. And our goal here is to spread it even farther out. So you did it to the person who was slightly more difficult, neutral, very difficult, and then yourself. And now close your eyes and imagine you are in the city that you are, or wherever you are. And imagine that this compassion has a particular color. For me, it's a kind of pinkish color. Imagine as you breathe, you spread this compassion out from where you are sitting right now, out into the rest of the city. Watch it spread out all over the city with each breath that you take. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be joyous. May you be safe. May you be healthy. Go ahead and rise up above the city a little bit as you watch it spread out all over the city. In the city of Los Angeles, there's about 12 million people. Whoo! Watching it spread all over those people, and they can get a little bit of that, and that comes right back to you as they say it to you. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be joyous. May you be safe. May you be healthy. And take another deep breath and allow it to spread out all over the state that you're in, state, province, wherever you are, the next larger entity. So California is 40 million people. So I'm like, send all the way out to California. Imagine that whole map of California lighting up, or New York, or Washington, D.C., wherever you are. May you be happy, California. May you be at ease. May you be safe. May you be healthy. Imagine that color of compassion, whatever you picked, spreading all over that place. And then allow it to cover the entire country. Watch it move all over the whole country, wherever you are, spreading all over as you say to all of them, maybe in a really loud stadium voice now, from way above the country, from where you can see the whole country. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be joyous. May you be healthy. May you be safe. Imagine that color of compassion completely encompassing the entire country that you're in. As you now pull out a little further and allow that compassion to encompass the entire globe, the whole thing. And go ahead and once again say, may you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be joyous. May you be safe. May you be healthy. And allow yourself to feel a little bit of that coming back. So you got 7.5 billion people out there, and allow some of that metta, that compassion, to come right back to you. May you be happy. May you be joyous. May you be at peace. May you be at ease. May you be safe. May you be healthy. Imagine what it's like to even get a tiny little bit from all those 7.5 billion people as you now allow all sentient beings to be included. So all the animals, all the plants, all the fishes in the sea, everything is now part of your circle of compassion as you say, may you be happy. May you be joyous. May you be at peace. May you be safe. May you be at ease. May you be healthy. Everything is now included in your circle of compassion. As a final part of this meditation, I invite you to imagine the spinning globe and see that every other person in the world who is meditating with us right now, including the people who are on this call, people who are on Facebook, and people who are regular meditators, there's probably tens of thousands, if not millions of them, right? A million people meditating, that's less than 0.01% of the population. It's a pretty reasonable number. And imagine all those points of light on the globe as it spins around, all those people that are meditating with us, and rejoice that we are all doing this together. And express your gratitude for doing this as a group, as a team, all the people wishing peace, compassion, wellness, and safety for everyone and for one another. Give it a big woohoo! All right. How you feeling? Welcome to the call, those who just logged on, and the people on Facebook. Welcome. So we just did a metta, that's M-E-T-T-A meditation, putting that in the little chat thingy right here. And also known as loving kindness. So let's see what we got here. Unmute all. How are you feeling, folks? How was that for you? Pretty good?
How about you? How are you feeling?
Like that?
I miss the audience because I get all of my value from their friends.
All right. You know, fantastic. So that was today's meditation. Hope you liked it. And we've done a bunch of different kinds of meditation. Tomorrow I will do the Wheel of Awareness meditation as developed by Dr. Dan Siegel of UCLA. He's a neuropsychiatrist. It's a fantastic meditation. It's kind of a big mashup of all the great meditation techniques all in one. So I really hope you can be there for that tomorrow. In the meantime, if you have questions, welcome Kimberly and Pasadena. If you have questions, please put them in the chat box and I will be more than happy to attend to them. So remember that whenever you share your issues, you are truly sharing because you are not going to be alone with whatever is happening to you. Whatever issue you are experiencing, chances are very good that it's common to everybody else who's in the room. We're all human after all, so we're all in similar predicaments. A little bit of isolation, a little bit of illness of self and friends and family maybe, loss of income, feeling cooped up. Maybe you're stuck in a place with someone you don't like that much. Yesterday we had someone who was actually stuck at home with her abusive husband. And these are all situations that are challenging. So it's important to develop the mental resilience and the support network that we have right here to be able to handle these challenges. So yesterday I talked about the five principles, the five happiness action principles. And I also touched upon the two of the thieves of happiness. So today I'm going to talk about three thieves of happiness, because at the same time that it's important to build up your happiness capabilities and do the things that move you towards growth and health and resilience, at the same time it's good to be aware of the things that may be taking away from your happiness, because you can always add good things and also subtract the not so great things. So the three thieves of happiness that I want to talk about today are comparison, consumption, and compulsion. So what are these three things? So I talked about yesterday about the book, The Social Leap by Professor William von Hippel, which is amazing. It's all about how humans became more social animals and descended from trees, and they started walking on two legs on the savanna. And as a result of becoming much more of a cooperative species. We're able to overcome all these very big predators and also hunt down much larger prey and basically dominate the planet. And 7.5 billion people later, and 300,000 years later, we're doing pretty good. And at the same time, we have these minds that developed by evolution for living on the savannah 300,000 years ago. So hunter-gatherers, feast or famine, you know, you get a hunt, you hunt something down, guess what? You have to share it with other people because, A, that's good for the whole tribe, but also it's not like you can put that antelope in a freezer. It's going to spoil, so you have to consume right then and there. People didn't have much property, so a lot of these things have changed in the past 300,000 years. May have noticed that now we have Wi-Fi, and they did not. We got cars, they did not. We have supermarkets, they did not. So, and there's aspects of our lives that were adaptive then that aren't very adaptive to us now. And this is what is called evolutionary mismatch. And it turns out to be a lot of the reason why we are kind of making ourselves miserable these days because of these evolutionary mismatches. I mean, really simple example, which I'll touch upon even more deeply when I get to consumption, is that, look, we are programmed to eat as much sweet stuff and fatty stuff as possible when we encounter it. Why? Because that stuff used to be pretty rare. If you found it, you gorge yourself. And then when you can't find food for a while, it's cool because you have these reserves on your body. But when you can walk into Whole Foods and the whole stash of like candy and chocolate and cake, well, suddenly that formerly useful adaptation is not very helpful anymore. And it leads to Americans being 60% overweight and about 33% obese. So how do we rein that in? What do we do to reconfigure our environment such that these ancient adaptations don't bring us down these days? So first, let's talk about comparison. So comparison is an innate feature of the human brain and of any social creature. We are hyper-social creatures. We got to where we are because we were social, because we cooperated. So this comparison thing is not going away anytime soon. And the comparison engine is why things like gossip magazines exist. It's why shows like Real Housewives of New York exist. It's why everything in the world has something to do with status, and we are hyper-conscious of status. Even though right now we live mostly in these metropolitan areas where, you know, rank isn't quite as obvious. Before, we used to live in these groups of 30 to 150 people. And if you look at chimps, that's about the number they've got, about 30 people. And everybody knows where they were in the hierarchy. So, you know, a female chimp knew that I'm number 7 of all the females. And the guy knows, okay, I'm number 11, so I can pick on number 12, but I need to be nice to number 10. Whereas here, you don't really know exactly where you stand, but you kind of have a sense based on neighborhood you live in, your income, and all these other things. So we have these ancient brains that are hypersensitive to status and rank, and yet we live in these times when you don't really have to be, because then your rank and status had a direct bearing upon your access to food and mating resources. And if you were lower status, you just simply went without, because the higher status people got fed first and you did not. And you did not have access to mating opportunities either. The people who were ranked higher, they got all the opportunities and you were kind of shut out. But now it's just not like that. You can walk into a supermarket and get all the food you need anytime you want. So you have access to food. And for the most part, there's enough people to go around and there isn't that hierarchy and there isn't one person who mops up all the mating opportunities. It's pretty even, much more evenly distributed. And yet still we have these machines going on. So what do you do? What do you do to avoid the thief of happiness called comparison, social comparison? Well, there's a couple of things you can do. You can stop feeding it. So magazines, TV, all these mass culture devices, mass media devices, they are supported by advertising, which is designed to make you feel miserable about yourself. Not just that, but the shows themselves, like these reality TV shows, like The Real Housewives of X Town, they are designed, again, around status and making you feel less than, okay? And there's a very interesting study I'd like to cite. So this was done, I think, by some Harvard scientists, and they gave this scenario to folks and they said, hey, here's this mock society in which you are going to make $100,000 and your friends are going to make $80,000. Are you cool with that? They're like, yeah, that's awesome. And let's say right now you make significantly less than $100,000. So that's a big jump for you. It's like, all right, no brainer. Great. Now let's say you're in this situation and, you know, before you were making, and you, let's say you started out with $35,000 was your base salary. Okay. So it's going from 35 to 100. That's awesome. And all the other people are making less. That's even better. Right. Then they said, hey, what if you were making 80 and your friends were making 100? And a vast majority of people said, nope, don't want it. I'm like, what? What the hell? You're making 80. That's more than twice what you were making before. And then they gave another scenario. They said, what if you were making 50 and they're making, what if you were making 25 and they're making 20? And they took that over making 80 and their friends making 100. So think about that, right? The absolute salary, which is basically access to resources, ability to go on trips and cruises and, you know, drink really nice tequila, whatever you want to do. So that didn't matter nearly as much as the relative amount. So we are these creatures of comparison. So what you want to do is you want to not feed the machine. So you don't feed the machine by not buying magazines that involve a lot of comparison ads in there, not watching TV that does that. And in recent years, we've got this super pernicious engine of comparison. It's called social media. And social media is all about comparison. I mean, that's the whole thing it runs on. It's like, oh, how many likes did I get? Oh, do people like me? So this is hijacking this ancient mechanism inside your brain for the benefit of Facebook, for the benefit of Instagram, which is Facebook, to the benefit of Snap or whatever the hell the company is. So they're basically using this ancient mechanism you had in your brain to make you miserable and thereby make money. So what you can do is you cannot do that. Okay. So first thing you want to do is not flip through that kind of stuff and the infinite scroll, which also plugs into an ancient mechanism of our brain, which is the foraging instinct, to forage for food. There's no stopping the foraging. You will always forage, right? And this until you fill yourself up. But this is an infinite scroll, so it's an infinite forage. That's hijacking another system to make you miserable. So you want to A, not use it, and two, you want to not participate in it. So, you know, it makes me sad. Every once in a while, I plug into Instagram just to see if there's some messages in there. Otherwise, I don't have these apps on my phone at all. And what I see is like these really lovely friends of mine who I know are struggling with issues around food and looks and body image and all that. And some of them, you know, maybe started a little heavier than they were before and they're on this journey. And every day they record themselves, they do a little something, maybe doing push-ups or some juice they made. And then they look at the likes and the things and man, you just gotta stop that shit. You know, that is poison to your soul because now you're feeding that comparison engine even more. So what do you do instead? And what I recommend instead is to express gratitude, because the fact that we're here at all is this insane, unbelievable miracle. Okay. So let me give you an example. So did your parents live long enough to have you? Okay. That's a silly question, right? Of course they live long enough to have you, right? So your parents live long enough to live to a reproductive age and have you, and you grew up and you're here on this call. Amazing, right? Okay, good. So did your parents' parents live long enough to have your parents? Again, silly question, right? Of course, your parents' parents lived long enough such that they were able to have your parents who had you in turn. See where I'm going here? Okay, so grandparents, great-grandparents, right? Great-great-grandparents. So every single one of them had to live long enough to have kids who survived and then have kids of their own. Okay, so you as you're standing here right now, I want you to imagine, close your eyes, and imagine behind you, your parents, that's two, their parents, that's four, them, that parents, their parents, eight, their parents, 16, behind them, 32, behind them, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, 4096, 8192, 19,384, and so on. It goes on and on and on, 100,000 unbroken generations. You are the survivor of 100,000 generations of the human race. That is an incontrovertible fact. If that were not true, you would not be here today. Think about that. Think about that legion of people, which once we get to 18,000, that's already a stadium full of humans, right? But it's a lot more than that. It's the entire human race. It's all 100 billion people by the end are going to be included in it. So you are their survivor. And they're all standing behind you and they're saying, oh my God, you made it. I am so proud. You are my offspring. You are going to do amazing things. And amazing things are awaiting you. In the meantime, you're like grabbing your tummy fat going, oh, I'm not worthy. This is terrible. Give it a break. Okay. You're a miracle. There is no doubt about that. You are a miracle. So might as well start acting like one. And the best way you can act like one is to convey to other people how miraculous they are too. Just because there's 7 billion people does not make anyone less of a miracle. You, as you are sitting there right now, utterly fucking miraculous. And stop that comparison nonsense, okay? Just be fully present and appreciate the fact that we're here, we're alive, maybe we're cooped up, maybe we're not able to go to the restaurant we want to go to, maybe we're not able to go on the date we want to go out to, but being live is an amazing miracle. Okay, good. So comparison. That's one way you can put that comparison thing aside. So avoid social media. Avoid any kind of media that is prone to make you feel less than. And most important, don't participate in social media. All the posting, all the... Look, if you want to share with people, that's a really good way of using social media. If you want to put up a list of great books, movies you like, or... uplifting message, that's a really good use of social media. If you want to connect with old friends, great use of social media. But if it's some mechanism of you going, hi, look at me, there is no long-term upside to that because that's not a game you can win. So good. Comparison. Let's toss that to the side. The second thief of happiness is consumption and its corollary, compulsion. Now, I always say that the opposite of happiness is not unhappiness. It's not depression. The opposite of happiness is compulsion. Because when you have compulsion, you no longer have freedom. When you have compulsion, you are compelled to do certain things that don't necessarily make you happy. You just kind of have to do them. And a very good example of compulsion is addiction, addictive behavior. So if you talk to a junkie or if you read accounts of how junkies behave, they'll tell you, hey, I don't actually derive any pleasure from the heroin anymore. I just want to be not miserable. And what is a more miserable situation to be in than to depend on something for your fix all the time? And again, there is no need to knock down this aspect of being human because it is built in and it has survival value. We used to live in these feast and famine conditions on the savannah where one day you had a big kill, you had meat, or you found a nice little bush of berries, and you gorge yourself, life is good. But hey, no fridge, no harvest, nothing. Therefore, anytime there was food to be had, you made sure that you gulped down as much of it as possible. So consumption was good because that ensured your survival and by extension, the survival of your offspring. Now, what happened was that we then got transplanted to these environments like today, where you can walk into Whole Foods or Erewhon or Ralph's and there's access to unlimited food. And there's these crazy things like soft drinks. Basically, soft drinks and potato chips are responsible for most of the Americans' weight gain. So this stuff plugs directly into that circuitry inside your brain that says, consume, otherwise you will die. And your brain takes that shit seriously. So it's like, okay, Coke, chips, everything. And that can be the kind of thing that leads to the thief of happiness known as compulsion. Okay, so you are right now in a great spot, right? Because you just meditated, compassion everywhere, feeling good, okay, right? But maybe if somebody put a whole bunch of candy and sugary foods and cake and dessert in front of you, maybe certain parts of your brain circuitry will be tripped and you go, ooh, want, need. Maybe it's a different kind of compulsion. Maybe it's a compulsion for, I don't know, validation. Maybe it's a compulsion for exercise. Maybe it's a compulsion for, I'm not quite sure what your particular compulsion is. Maybe it's for sex. There's an infinite number of things that can hook into that compulsion circuitry inside your brain, okay? And what was formerly useful, which helped you survive, has now become an instrument for you becoming unhappy. So, what do we do about consumption and compulsion? That's a tough one. Again, we are embedded in these societies where we have these entities with multi-billion dollars telling us multi-billion dollar budgets for advertising and marketing saying, consume, 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 okay? So this is a tough place to be in. What do you want to do? You want to become familiar with your own feelings. That's what you want to do. So this is why meditation is so important. Part of the meditation we're going to do tomorrow involves a body scan. And when you get better and better at the body scan, what happens is you become more familiar with your own feelings, your own internal sensations. And so when you have a feeling that's like, must have, then you're like, oh, I recognize that feeling. That feeling is not me. It's just a feeling, right? So what you can do is you can step back from that, take a couple of breaths. And the great thing about feelings is that they come and go. So you have the feeling and you just let it dissipate. So that is totally possible. And meditation helps, but also just doing that stepping back is very effective. What's worked really well for me is physical barriers. You want to design your space such that the compulsions are something that you can control. So for example, if I have a Twinkie addiction and I have a whole bunch of Twinkies in the fridge, actually you don't need to put in the fridge, they last forever. They're indestructible. Actually not even made, but just as an example, right? If I have a whole bunch of it at home, then every time I walk by the Twinkie stash, I have to exert my willpower. And willpower is hard. Willpower doesn't really work very well. What you want to do is environmental setup such that you don't have to use willpower. So what do? If your compulsion is around food, which is definitely possible around these times when you are isolated, you're not connected to friends, right? You're cut off. What you want to do is you want to make sure those things aren't in your home at all. If you don't have a tub of dryer's ice cream in the fridge, you are not going to eat that tub of dryer's ice cream. Instead, you can have fruit. You can have something healthy, a healthy snack, something else. You can just drink some water, which will take the edge off. So you want to have environmental constraints designed in your living space, which make it easier to avoid the compulsions, whatever it is, right? So for me, one of the compulsions I have that I know I have is email. Email is like tapping on that bar in the rat cage that, you know, jacks up the, hits the brain in the pleasure center. So what do you do with that is you maybe close the browser. Or you just close the computer. And that way, when you look at it, it's not as tempting. Or maybe you just do something else first thing in the morning so you don't check email first thing in the morning. So whatever it is, create the environment such that the behavior that you want to do is predisposed. And that's another thing. What is the thing that you want to do instead? So opportunity cost is real. So opportunity cost just means that at any point in time, you can do one thing to the exclusion of all the other things. Right? So if you're giving it a compulsion, that's one of the big problems with addiction, which is that if you're too busy being a heroin junkie, shooting up and looking for your next fix, guess what else? Guess what things you can't do? You can't look after your family. You can't have fun. You can't go to a concert. You can't flourish as the full human being you want to be because so much of your time and energy is taken up by this thing, right? So what do you want to do instead? Schedule that in. Put that exactly where you think the compulsion might happen. And two more things about compulsions, which is that one, you can use the compulsion machinery towards something good, right? You can use that same thing towards a habit like exercise. You can use that towards a habit like healthy eating. So you can take that same machinery that may be compelled to do something that's destructive to you and use it to do something positive. And it works the same way. And something like exercise is particularly amenable And I don't think any of you is going to go off and become like ultra marathoners all of a sudden and break your knees that way. That is not what I'm worried about. What I'm worried about is, are you getting 20 minutes of exercise daily? 40, they say, is the sweet spot, but 20 will be great if you moved for 20 minutes a day every day. So use that same machinery that can potentially compel you to do things that aren't all that great for you and hijack it towards the goals that you want. And finally, the most effective, the most powerful bulwark against compulsion is connection. So I cite this experiment often of Disneyland rat cage versus, you know, barren rat cage. So they put rats in these cages and they have a lever that can give them cocaine or heroin laced water. So the rat in the isolated cage, the barren cage, it'll go there and it'll just tap on there every minute and get a little hit and it'll get addicted and eventually go, ugh, and keel over. And you put the rats in the Disneyland cage where they have treadmills and they have fun things to jump around in and hide and they have a whole bunch of other rats and they're being social, right? They don't even bother touching the bar. They completely ignore the cocaine lace water. Why? Because they have connection. So compulsion is often a replacement for connection. And hey, maybe if it's something as simple as like biting your nails, just notice when you do it more and when you do it less. If you're amongst friends having fun, when do you even have time to worry about biting your nails, right? But when you're alone, you're a little nervous, you're wondering about where your next paycheck's going to come from, it starts to go up. And there's any number of compulsions that are that way. So use that with a little compulsion that you have as a sign that, hey, maybe what I'm lacking here is a little connection, then pick up the phone and call somebody and be the person who lifts somebody else up. One of the best ways to cheer yourself up is to cheer somebody else up. So these are all things that are in your power. They cost nothing and you can do them. I have total faith in you. So those are the thieves of happiness. So that would be the three things were compulsion, which comes out of consumption. And then the first one was, what was the first one? Comparison, right? Social comparison. And the key thing is not to crash down on yourself, not to say, oh my God, I'm a horrible person. I did a social comparison again. Look, this is what we do. So status threat is always in the back of our mind because, oh no, my status in the tribe got threatened. Therefore, I may not get any more food. Well, guess what? Your food's still in the fridge. You're good. You're fine. So just notice that this is ancient programming there. And once again, the more you meditate, the more you're able to take a step back and look at the thoughts floating around and notice, I am not my thoughts. I am the screen upon which the thoughts are projected. Aren't those thoughts interesting? Aren't they cute? So that way they don't have nearly as much dominion over you. All right, good. Thank you, Virginia. Thank you, Clemens, for watching. Okay, so questions. Now is a good time for questions. All right, how y'all doing? I just opened up your microphone. So if you were loudly picking your nose, now I can hear you. All right, how you doing? Good?
Good, now.
Woohoo! All right. Any questions so far? Or more important, we're now in the 15 minutes of Q&A at the end, so what are your concerns? What's going on in your world? What is it that if you had a magic wand and you could wave it, change it, and turn it into something much more pleasant and manageable, what would you like that to be? What would you change?
I don't know if my voice comes through. Can you hear me?
Yes. Is that Christine?
Oh. No, it's Niloufar. It's Niloufar.
Oh, Niloufar. Okay, excellent. Okay, so I'm going to mute everybody except for you. And that way... All right. Yes, you are coming through loud and clear. So what's going on?
Awesome. So I'm wondering, my biggest obstacle for meditation is I can sit down and do it, but there's this thought that if I'm calmer, if I'm serene, I won't be able to accomplish as much. I won't be able that. Restlessness helps me accomplish or something, like something bad could happen if I'm too calm. How do you overcome? So you meditate more probably, but how do you overcome something like that?
Yeah, this is fantastic. So, you know, every time I go to a talk by one of these really wise people, like say Jack Kornfield or Joe Goldstein or Sharon Salzberg, any of these people, I always ask them, how does one reconcile equanimity with ambition? Because they are exactly in conflict with one another. Equanimity means I am perfectly happy the way things are. And that does not lend itself very well to, I must improve things. I must go out there and conquer and build and excel. These are exactly the opposite things. Okay, so how do you reconcile these two things? And it turns out there is a body of research that shows that the happier you are, the less ambitious you are going to be. Well, there you go. So this is good news for all the people out there who are medium achievers. And if you are that person, and maybe you're not that inclined to get the new title, get the corner office, and make a zillion bucks, it's probably because you're already pretty happy. And it is a definite fact that a lot of people who are hyper successful are just a bunch of miserable fucks. I mean, they ask Elon Musk, how do you do all this? And he says, I just have a high tolerance for pain. And I got a lot of it when I was a kid. And he had apparently a childhood so miserable that he still refuses to talk about it. So if you do not have a lot of pain in your life, chances are you're going to be slightly less ambitious and super duper motivated. Unless you are able to hack your own machinery. The question is, why are you doing the things that you are doing in the first place? What is the ambition towards? And if your goal is towards building something useful for other people, if you have some kind of higher goal, some goal that includes something bigger than you, then you're still going to be driven. And from this platform of equanimity, you're going to be much more able to give your gift anyway. But if it's just about you and, I'll make a few hundred thousand more dollars and I'll be maybe a little happier, maybe not, it's just not going to be as compelling. So the key is to figure out what your own values are. And your values, I'm not quite sure what they are, but speaking from this context of altruism as being something that really motivates people, cooperation, something that really motivates people because we're super social beings, something along those lines is more likely to move you. So a good exercise to sit down and figure out what your top 10 values are. And from those top 10 values, extract maybe the top 3 or 4. And then find the elements within whatever work you're doing that speak to those values. And then say, yeah, this is why I'm doing this. So there's a lady, her name is Amy Vrevznievsky. I think that's how she pronounced her name. I think she's at Yale Business School. And she talks a lot about job crafting. And the idea of job crafting is, hey, you've got this job. What is it about that job that moves you? What is it about this job that is meaningful and worthwhile to you? So it's the same job, but now you're putting a frame around it such that it's more meaningful to you. And then you can attend to those aspects of the job that in turn enrich the meaning in your work. So are you willing to share any specific examples of like where you feel like you could be more ambitious?
I'm trying to be calmer, but I'm trying to be more calm. But I think if I'm more calm, then I won't actually do enough to either. I mean, in this pandemic, maybe if I'm too calm, I won't do enough to protect myself. I mean, I know it's silly, right? The calmer I am, I can actually take more effective steps to protect myself and my family. Okay. But it's an overall theme. I find that's my biggest, I think almost, well, it's not subconscious anymore because I'm sharing it, but that's my biggest obstacle for meditation is I think if I'm calm, then I won't be, exercising as much, or I won't be, for example, exercising as much. But I have yet to find that that's true. I think it's just a lie.
So you're not quite there yet. Okay, great. In the meantime, let's work towards the calm. And once you're like super duper calm and you're then... from there, then we can reassess. But if you're not quite there yet, I would encourage everyone to get to that point. That's a really high quality problem to have. You have so much equanimity in your life that you're like, super duper zen, just sitting there. I mean, that said, that is one of my objections to a lot of traditional Buddhist practice. So you have these people out in, say, India or Burma, and what they do is they try to generate as little karma as possible, and they have no possessions. They have their begging bowl. They have their one meal at 11 a.m. and they go and they meditate all day. How are you a useful entity to the world when you do that, right? And that's probably one of the reasons why Jack Kornfield quit, and he came back and he got his PhD and he became a force for enormous good in the world. So that's the thing. Remember that we're here on this earth to give our gift. And giving our gift does not involve just sitting there and doing nothing. So yes, you start there. You start there and you meditate, and that involves a whole bunch of doing nothing. And that's the ground. That's the foundation from which right action can follow. Otherwise, we're just running around and putting our energy into things that maybe aren't that worthwhile and not helping the world.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Great question. Thank you. That was a great question. Okay. Fantastic. Good. More questions. What else do we have here? I'm sure you guys have all of your problems solved, but if you do not, please zap them my way. You can either raise your hand, you can unmute yourself.
More. Hello. Hey.
Hey, is that April?
Yes.
Fantastic. How are you doing, April?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. And do you have a video where I can see you or no? I mean, if you're having a bad hair day, I totally understand. I'm having a no hair day. So, you know, I think it's fair. So you're having a fantastic hair day. Okay, go on.
So my question is developing meaningful connections.
Great. Okay. So what's the question?
How to do that.
How to do that. So tell me what's going on. Really tell me what's going on right now, and perhaps I can lead you from there.
I'm single parent, 4 kids. Mm-hmm. So obviously right now that would be challenging given that I can't really go anywhere.
Okay.
But even prior to that, after having moved, you know, from different states and whatnot, and I just don't have a lot of that. I mean, I'm fine with my kids, you know, my family connections are good, but outside of that, I don't have much.
Right. Okay, great. So I understand that. And I'm guessing you want these connections with people who are age appropriate for you and not, say, 7-year-olds?
Correct, yeah.
Ah, yes, that's a challenge. So I've never been a parent, but I've been around people who are parents, and I was once a pesky little kid myself. So I get it. I get the whole hunger for connection and speaking to somebody who's your own age and all that. So the question is, how much of a priority is this in your life? And the way you know it's a priority is by the amount of time you devote to it specifically. And you can say that, well, I have 4 kids, I'm a single mom, therefore I have no time. But I bet you there's certain things you are already doing that don't have to do with the kids all the time. There are some little bits of time that you can find to devote to some things that you want to do. So would you be willing to set aside time on a weekly basis to this task specifically?
Yes.
Okay, good. And is it possible? Do you have, say, an hour or two to use to build these friendships?
Yes.
Okay, good. So now I'm guessing you didn't get to be a mother of 4 by having no friends whatsoever. So are there pre-existing friends?
I mean, lots of acquaintances, mm-hmm. but I don't know if I use that term more sparingly.
Okay.
Because to me, I would want a more meaningful friendship.
Okay.
And I don't have like set socializing, you know, like a friends group. Do you know what I mean? You know, where you're going to go to each other's houses and have mm-hmm. game nights or whatever. You know, I maybe had that at one point, and then after a divorce, sometimes you just lose an entire group of friends that would have been your social life, and then rebuilding that is non-existent.
Right. So, okay, so here are some suggestions. So first of all, you have some acquaintances, and perhaps you can start building from there, right? So I recently read a book where it said that it takes about 40 hours to turn an acquaintance into a stranger into like an acquaintance, and it takes another like 80 hours to turn that person into a friend within the inner circle of friendship. So the main thing that needs to happen here is more time spent with them. So first step is find the people that you want to devote more time to and be more connected to, and do that deliberately. And whether that's by calling them, by setting something up to hang out, going for a walk, but you're going to do this deliberately. And you know what? It's going to be a little challenging because some of these people you haven't spoken to in a while. Some of these people are like, what does she want from me? But it's a gradual process. And the idea is that if a year from now you have 12 new friends, it's a pretty good deal, right?
Right.
We're not expecting this to happen overnight. So right now you have a stash of acquaintances, and you can pick the ones that you think are going to be worthwhile for you. And if you don't think this is like, these are the kind of people that you want to have in your life, that's fine too. But there's probably a few of them, at least one or two, whom you would like to reconnect with more deeply. And usually people are pretty open to that, especially under these circumstances. So that's one. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I really believe in is activity-centered socials. Activity-centered social events. So there's an app, there's a website app called meetup.com where there's listings for all kinds of groups of people doing all kinds of crazy things. So you can go on there. And are you in a major metropolitan area by any chance?
No.
Smaller? Okay.
Yeah, like maybe 30,000.
Okay, so it's smaller. Okay. Chances are you still have meetup groups there, so you can go on there and see what's there and find some mutual interests. And then all you have to do is show up. It's really easy. And from there, you can have brand new friends who don't know who you were before, with whom you can build a whole brand new friendship, and it's all fine. And so that's a new way to bring new people into the pipeline. The other thing is, as a mom, you are probably not alone, and especially as a single mom. And you probably have other single moms in your city, in your neighborhood. So is there a way to find them and to spend time with them? And maybe you have play dates and you hang out with the mom and the kids play with each other. So that's a whole community of people who would potentially be open to hanging out with you. There's also this resource called Nextdoor.com, which it probably exists in your neighborhood. And Nextdoor is all about your neighbors. So you go on there and you get to know your neighbors. So I don't know how close your neighbors are to you physically, but I'm guessing you have some neighbors. Yes, no?
Yes.
Okay, good. So how well do you know your neighbors?
Casually.
Casually. Okay, good. So that's a great start. Americans used to know their neighbors well. And if you think about it, when you get in a jam, who's in the best position to help you out? Your neighbors. So maybe now is a good time to reach out to them, bake them some banana bread, take it and say, hey, neighbor, how you doing? How you holding up in these circumstances? And establish that connection and start nurturing it. And you don't, it's not necessary to like throw a big old barbecue and invite everybody in the neighborhood, which is hard to do now anyway. But start small. Start with the smallest amount that you can do easily and then build on it because it's going to feel good. If you do it and you succeed, you're going to go, oh, wow, that worked. And that was pretty good. That wasn't so hard. And then you do more. Then you do slightly more and it becomes a habit. But most important is to make it a priority. And however you do that. So the way I know it's a priority for me is I put it on the calendar and then it happens. And then it's blocked out and I won't do the other things. I will do that. So those are some ideas to start. Does that sound reasonable?
Yes.
Yeah. And normally I would say start throwing parties, but you can't do that now. So now it's a much more retail environment. It's one-on-one. You call people up. It's like, hey, I'm calling you specifically because I want to talk to you. How are you doing? And people respond very well to concern and being cared for specifically. So I would say start there. And if you keep doing this on a regular basis, even 1 hour a week, I bet you this time next year, you will have more friends you can possibly handle.
Yes.
All right. Thank Great you. Question. Thank you. Fantastic. Great. All right. So Sanjay asks, what is the default state of mind? How to recognize, how to modulate, how to improve quality of daily thoughts? So whew, that's a pretty good question. So why not get Sanjay on here and have you ask the question out loud? Are you willing to do that, Sanjay?
Okay.
What do you mean by default state of mind?
Like when you're not doing anything, you get different thoughts in the mind. So I'm guessing for humanity, what kind of thoughts other people think? Like for me, I get the thoughts of he said, she said. I replay the conversations from prior days or something.
Well, fantastic. That's a very insightful question. And it's actually the subject of a large and recent body of research in the past 20 years. And what scientists found was that they put somebody in a imaging machine, they put them in the tube, right? And they tell them, hey, stop having all thoughts, stop all thoughts. And then the brain wouldn't stop. There's this particular circuit that kept on going. And they're like, what is this thing? We, you know, everything is supposed to be quiet here and it's not. And it's called the default mode network. It even has the default in there. The word default is built into it. So the default mode network basically has social thoughts all the time. And that has to do with the fact that we are social beings and we are super sensitive to rank and our position in the hierarchy. So if you're just sitting there doing nothing, boom, default mode network comes right back on and goes, boop, it starts ruminating over your connections, your friendships and stuff like that. So and the default mode network isn't necessarily bad. It's there and it's also related to our creativity. The thing is, how are you feeding it and how are you dealing with it? So if you decide that that's the thing that bothers you and you use it as an engine of rumination and comparison, that will break you down because of all the stuff we talked about today earlier on, the comparison engine, right? At the same time, the more you practice meditation, the more you're able to direct your mind where you want it to go. And And that way, if you have these thoughts, you're like, oh, I'm having these thoughts. Isn't that interesting? You can take one step back and have them not bother you as much. So it's also very important to practice solitude. So solitude in the form of, say, going for a walk by yourself, or, you know, doing meditation for a little while, or even going somewhere on vacation by yourself. And the whole notion of being comfortable with being alone and being comfortable with your own thoughts, because a lot of the times it's people just being afraid of their own thoughts that makes them uncomfortable, right? But the fact is, thoughts by themselves cannot harm you. Your mind is like this TV screen, and thoughts are like the programming that come on the TV screen. And you can put whatever programming you want on the TV screen, and the TV screen's not going to break. Try it. You can put on, you know, a bunch of barbarians bashing each other with clubs, and the TV screen will not break. You could have on there people shooting, and it won't break. And have on there, Disney's Frozen, and play it for the 12,000th time because you could ask for it, and it still won't break. When you turn it off, the screen is still there. So the more you identify with the screen, which is your pure consciousness, the more you can disidentify with those thoughts and those feelings of comparison, basically the more equanimity you are going to have. And the best way to do it is just practice, practice, practice. So meditation is a good way of doing that. And also deciding what you want to think about. So do you have some idea of what you would rather be doing with the default mode network?
I rather put time into constructive activities rather than ruminating.
Great. Fantastic. Okay. So how do we go about doing that? Is it possible to schedule that into your day? Is it possible to block out time to do that? Because all you have to do is do something else and the default mode network goes away. It's the default. So if you choose to do something else, then the default mode network is not on. At the same time, I would encourage you to not abolish it entirely, because the default mode network could be a source of great creativity, and those random thoughts can sometimes get you somewhere. But I totally understand if you'd rather be doing something else. So so give me an example of something else that's productive that you would rather do instead of ruminating.
Look for a job.
Okay, great. So is it possible to put that on your calendar and have an alarm set off and go, okay, for the next hour, do that? So my technique for that is I have this thing called a Pomodoro timer. And you don't need a Pomodoro timer. You can just use any timer. But the idea is you go like this. You go 5500, right? Boom. And you set it going. And then what you're doing is you're saying, for the next 55 minutes, I am not going to be interrupted by anything. Not by phone calls, not by texts, not by social media, not by other people. I'm just going to do this one thing. And that one thing may be doing your taxes. It may be something like looking for a job. And these are things that aren't necessarily all that fun to do, but they are fulfilling to do once you've done them. So you do that. And that way, with this little 55-minute contract, you've trapped yourself. You can't avoid it. You do it. And then afterwards, you're like, woohoo, you celebrate a little bit, and it's done. The key thing is to schedule it and put it on there. If you just wait for inspiration to hit or to feel like it, it's not going to happen. So this is the thing that makes discipline easy. You just put it on the calendar and use the timer. So that's how I do it. Is that helpful?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Fantastic. All right. Great. So these are some great questions you have here. Very insightful, very deep, very useful for all the other people in the room. So are there more questions? So I thought it was a question here. Okay. I can't see it. I can't see the question here on Facebook Live, but I can see your questions here on Zoom. So if you have further questions, please let me know. I'm going to unmute all of you. How are you all doing? Good?
Good.
Fantastic. Any more questions, please do not be shy. Now is a good time to ask them, because I'm here to do specifically that. Okay. Good, good, good. Well, thank you very much for attending. This has been session 9 of the Staying Sane in Trying Times session with Dr. Ali Benazir. Thank you so much for your attention. We're going to have the next one. We're going to have the next one tomorrow at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. and that would be 7 in the evening, 1900 hours, London time, and An Ungodly Hour of the Morn by Australian time, at which time I hope you are still asleep. So, hope you can join us then. Tomorrow's session is going to be dynamite. Very powerful stuff, very powerful techniques, potentially transformative. Thank you so much for your attention. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you be safe. May you be exceptionally asymptomatic and healthy. Thanks for joining me.